The narrator of the book Angela's Ashes is a boy growing up and surviving. In the beginning, he's a baby, born to Irish parents in Brooklyn, starving in the Depression. The family returns to Ireland, settling in the town of Limerick in the Southwest, but remains impoverished, malnourished, with the younger children dying of consumption. The boy thinks constantly of food, even licking the newspaper that contains his uncle's fish and chips.
He says there's no food in the house, not a scrap of bread, and when he falls asleep, I take the greasy newspaper from the floor. I lick the front page, which is all advertisements for films and dances in the city. I lick the headlines. I lick the great attacks of Patton and Montgomery in France and Germany. I lick the war in the Pacific. I lick the obituaries and the sad memorial poems, the sports pages, the market price of eggs, butter and bacon. I suck the paper till there isn't a smidgen of grease. I wonder what I'll do tomorrow.
Frank McCourt, reading from his book about the desperate times of his childhood in Ireland. McCourt says, for example, he had only one shirt, only one, to wear to school and to church day and night. And the first time he slept under clean sheets was when he had to go to the typhoid hospital. He was 10 years old. His family lived in the lanes of Limerick.
The lane is not like one of those leafy lanes you read in romantic poetry where the swain and her beau are walking down. It was a slum lane with the houses. You could stand in the middle of the lane and stick your arms out on both sides and touch the houses. We had no backyards and no indoor toilets, so there was one toilet at the end of the lane, one lavatory. And that was for the 11 families in the lane. And they'd come down there and stand at the door of that lavatory and just empty their buckets into that toilet bowl, sometimes missing it. One of my brothers would run in and say, "Oh, so-and-so is coming with a bucket. Close the door, close the door. Bucket alarm."
Would you read, please, Mr. McCourt, the paragraph about Michael, your younger brother, and his propensity for bringing home dogs into this very poor, very poor household?
Oh, Michael is just as bad. He brings home stray dogs and old men. You never know when he'll find a dog in the bed with him. There are dogs with sores, dogs with no ears, no tails. There's a blind greyhound he found in the park, tormented by children. Michael fought off the children, picked up the greyhound that was bigger than himself, and told Ma'am the dog could have his supper. Ma'am says, "What supper? We're lucky if there's a cut of bread in the house." Michael tells her the dog can have his bread. Ma'am says, "That dog has to go tomorrow," and Michael cries all night and cries worse in the morning when he finds the dog dead in the bed beside him. He won't go to the school because he has to dig a grave outside where the stable was, and he wants all of us to dig with him and say the rosary. Malik, he says, "It's useless saying prayers for a dog. How do you know he was even a Catholic?" Michael says, "Of course he was a Catholic. Didn't I have him in my arms?"
I like Michael in this book. Mm. The principal reason that your family has no money here really is your father's drinking. Is it not?
Yeah.
He would say to you boys, "Go on home, tell your mother, we'll be there in a bit, and I'll be there in a bit," and then he would go into a pub. Yeah.
Then we knew. We knew then. Because we were like little animals. We knew the procedure, that when he said, "Go home, I'll tell you," and tell you, the word, his language revealed itself, and his posture. We knew then that he wouldn't be bringing home the wages, and we'd look at my mother sitting by the fire in sunken despair. And the night would go on, and we knew it later on we'd hear him singing at the top of the lane.
Singing.
And next day, he'd singing his patriotic songs, Kevin Barry and the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Haul us out of bed, line us up, make us all promise that when we grew up, we'd all die for Ireland. So as I stated elsewhere in the book with him, he wanted us to die for Ireland for patriotic reasons. The church was always preaching about how we should grow up and go forth and be missionaries in Africa and other places and convert the heathen savage. And between the church wanting us to die for the church and him wanting us to die for Ireland, we wondered if anybody wanted us to live.
Hmm. You're right that you thought your father was like the Holy Trinity. He was one person in the morning, one person in the evening, and he could be the other person when he did the bad thing
in
the pubs.
When he was a good father, he was the perfect father. And that's the stuff I carry with me for the rest of my life, of him sitting by the fire telling me stories in the morning, times when I had him completely to myself, because he and I were early risers. And he would tell me stories and encourage me to go to school and get an education and come to America.
Hmm. Can you still hear his voice in your mind?
Oh, sure, yeah. That Northern Ireland accent.
What is that?
If he wanted me to get up and come on, Francis, we're going to go for a walk today. Do you want to go for a walk? And we'll have tea before we go. And we'd sit by the fire and he'd tell me stories about the ancient times of Cohoolan and Fermacool. Hmm. That was the kind of accent, completely different from the Limerick accent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you went into the typhoid hospital, you encountered the words of William Shakespeare for the very first time. Mm. How old were you then?
Ten.
And you say that you didn't understand the words, but it's like having jewels in my mouth when I say the words.
Yeah. I do believe, induced by potent circumstances, that thou art mine enemy. This was Shakespeare, and he was the man that I heard was the greatest poet and writer of all time. And I'd never had any opportunity to see words of his before, and I treasure them. But books were magic, but we had nothing else. There were newspapers and a rare and an occasional book that swam into our lives. So we seized on those books and we passed them from hand to hand. And then when they opened the children's branch of the Carnegie Library, we lined up there for a whole day waiting to get in. And the librarians were very severe. They used to examine our hands to make sure we had clean hands. In my case, I was sent out again to wash my hands. It was a rainy day, so I washed my hands in the gutter and went back in again. But we were only allowed to take out one book every 2 weeks, but we passed them around. So we were always reading. And since we didn't have electricity and the candle would run out or the paraffin oil would run out, we sat at the top of the lane under the street lamp and read in all kinds of weather till the mothers would start calling, "Come in, come in, come in, you're ruining your eyes above. Come in, you're all gone blind." And we'd peel away one by one. The mothers screaming at us about getting blind.
Your father goes off to work in England a couple of times during the war.
Yeah.
And is supposed to send money back, but hardly ever does. And you never saw him again. Have you thought over the years that you could run into him someplace or hear from him?
Well, I saw him in 1971.
Oh, you have?
In Belfast. I went up to see him, you know, when Belfast was going up in flames. And we had my uncle was there and there was a woman from the neighborhood. So it was a very formal conversation and I didn't have that much time and I couldn't get into anything with him. I wanted to dig in and ask him the obvious questions. Why did you do it? Why did you do it? But the next time I didn't. And the next time I saw him, he was in his coffin in 1985. And I went to his funeral. I don't know why I went to the funeral, but if you have any aspirations to write and you want to attend every ritual event in your life. So I went in and knelt and prayed by his coffin. And I was almost overcome with laughter because they had him wearing a little white silken bow tie. And I thought, this is absolutely incongruous. The man hardly ever never wore a bow tie in his life. And he looked ridiculous. Hmm. And I was shaking with laughter. I mean, inwardly, I'm glad it didn't burst out. And I'm sure my whole family are standing around. They say, look at poor Frank, he's overcome. And I was simply laughing inwardly. Hmm. But then after that, the prevailing feeling I had was sadness over a life wasted, his and my mother's.
You know, at the end of the book, when you leave Limerick and Ireland to come to America on the boat, I feel sad for your mother because you're leaving her in pretty desperate straits there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we sent money. I sent money, then Maliki sent money, Michael sent money. Then she came over eventually with my youngest brother, Alfie, for 3 weeks and stayed for 22 years. She came for Christmas and stayed forever till she died. But she always said, she always felt a loyalty. This is the ridiculous thing about it. She felt so loyal to Ireland, where she had spent her most miserable years. She said, I'll never give up my Irish citizenship. Well, all right.
Frank McCourt's memoir about his first 18 years is called Angela's Ashes. McCourt taught English in New York City. He is 66 years old. This is his first book.